Hello, and welcome to another episode of What the Kids Were Watching, the podcast all about the weird, wonderful, and terrible babysitter movies of our youth. My name is Sada. Joining me on the couch, as usual, is Raphael. Hello, Raph.
Nice to be on the couch with you again.
So today we have a fantastic guest star. I am so excited to introduce her. Today we have Reese Marino, also known as Miss Bookish Girl and Notorious MBG. Reese, how long have we known each other? You are one of the few people that I met on Twitter, and then we became friends IRL. We both followed Andrew Schaefer, the romance novelist, I think, and then we connected.
Is that how that happened? I couldn't remember.
I think so.
I honestly can't remember. I know I started following you because we had somebody in common. It must have been Andrew Schaefer. And I vaguely remember just randomly, oh, she's got a blog. And so this is your old blog. And so I went and I was a reader there. You wrote about your grandmother and then I wrote you a comment. And I think that's how that started.
Oh my God. So that's probably it. Okay, 8 years later, thank you so much again for your thoughtful comment. And thank you for reading my old blog.
If I only knew. I loved your old blog. It was great.
Thank you. So yeah, so welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here. It's my first podcast.
So how did you, y'all decide that this was the movie you wanted to do? I do not remember.
I don't know if this was one of the ones that I had suggested, but Sada had offered it up as one that I could participate in, and I was thrilled because this is one of my favorite movies from when I was a kid.
Yes,
so it was an easy decision.
I have notes on my phone somewhere that I was taking when we were in Vegas. As readers of my blog will know, I went to Vegas in November 2019 to see Dylan Francis, my idol, perform. And I went partially that weekend because Reese and her husband were there seeing Jerry Seinfeld. So we met up. We spent the day together. They walked. So far, you all walked from Caesar's Palace to the Venetian, which if anyone's been to Vegas, you know that that's like not a short walk.
Actually, further than that, but yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, they literally went the extra
mile.
But
we do that anyway. That's normal for us. So.
But we spent the day together. We had dinner together. We talked about movies that would be a good choice for having Reese on as a guest star. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this was on that list, but I'm super glad that it ended up being a good fit.
Yeah, no, I think it was, but I don't remember. It was also to blur.
That weekend was a fantastic blur. So
yes, it was.
I haven't even mentioned the movie that we're talking about. We are talking about the 1986. We are talking about the 1986 movie Space Camp. The movie with a cranky Kate Capshaw leading six plucky teens, five plucky teens and one plucky child into space because a robot granted their wish.
Yes.
I love this movie. I have a lot to say about it. So let's just get started. Who wants to go first? Raph, do you want to talk about the sort of technical backgrounds and fun facts?
I think Reese should actually introduce the movie. We got her on, and I think it's her right to lead.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I hope I don't let you down. Yeah, this movie, I have a few fun facts myself, so I will chime in with that. But yeah, this movie came out this summer of 86. Unfortunately for the movie, it was right after the explosion of the Challenger in January. I think that's part of what doomed it, but I loved this movie. I can't remember if I saw it in the theater or not, but yes, it does have a very cranky Kate Capshaw, and so many actors that became big later is very much look at who that is kind of movie, including for those with eagle eyes. If anybody was a fan of Doogie Howser in the 80s, then you will spot at least one actor in there that is not really an ascended extra, but he has a couple of lines. And he's the kind of actor that looks exactly the same as he did when he was a kid to an adult. His name is Mitchell Anderson. Yeah, so I love this movie. It's a nice adventure, and it takes place partially in space. I was a big NASA nerd when I was a kid. One of my prized possessions is a book by Sally Ride that's been signed.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. This thing was like catnip to me. So I didn't care that nobody saw it and nobody seemed to like it. I loved it. So
I think one thing that's really hard to sell to like latter generations is from the mid 70s through the mid 80s until about the Challenger disaster, what a mystique NASA had to it. Because this was after Star Wars, which is referenced a lot in the movie. But there was this sort of, I know a lot of people of our generation that just had this aspirational aspect of, I want to be an astronaut or an engineer or something involved with it. And I think this movie just built on that collective desire of kids to go to space. For me, I was slightly younger than the age of Max when the movie came out. So I know he's in there, even though he makes no sense logically, to give its audience surrogate to all of us that always wanted to go up and always spend some time up there. I have to admit, I hadn't seen this movie for years until Sada.
Yeah.
When we first got together, we rewatched it.
You're welcome.
And I sort of thought a little dismissively about the movie, like, oh, it's probably a cute little movie. Like, all the kids in the movie were popular outside of Lee Phoenix, as he is called at the time. Everybody else was in something big right before this movie. So
yes.
Wait, no, it was Tate Donovan's first movie, right?
It was his first movie.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about Kelly Preston, Larry B. Scott, Leia Thompson.
She was in, didn't she do Back to the Future like right after this or
right before?
Okay, then there you go.
That was a big hot cast, but I think it's very important that you have Max as the surrogate for us as little kids.
A baby Phoenix, Joaquin Phoenix.
Yep.
Baby Joaquin.
Rewatching this, it's hard for me to believe he's only 10. He does such a fantastic job.
So good.
But before we get too deep into the movie, I feel like one of us should summarize the plot. Who wants to do it? Who wants to be shuttle commander of this podcast?
Oh, okay, I'll do it.
Okay, good. I'll interrupt you.
It's about space camp, which is a real world place where kids can go through the experience of...
Sorry. I knew I was going to do this. Okay, so yes, it is about space camp, but it opens with this little girl looking at the sky. What was it? Which one was John Glenn in?
Is that one of the Gemini Project?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Yes, the Gemini Project. And she's all excited.
Called you, NASA nerd.
She thinks John Glenn has winked at her, and she's like, I'm going to go into space. Fast forward, she's an astronaut, but she's not going into space. She got bumped from her mission, so she's going to teach space camp instead.
You get to see space camp. They shot there for real, and you see the program that the kids actually get to go through over a several-week period. And it's about really what happens when Max becomes friends with Jinx, a very dangerous experimental AI robot for NASA. They develop a relationship, and since Max wants to go to space, Jinx sends him and a bunch of other kids to space when they are in the Atlantis.
Yes, they get to sit in the shuttle during the liftoff test, and then Max sets it up so that this shuttle has to take off or it's going to explode. So then they end up in space, they have to find more oxygen, and they have to find their way home, literally. It's very exciting. It's like two different movies. You know, the first one is just sort of this like fun, you know, learning about science. The kids get into kind of wacky adventures, a lot of phenomenal chemistry between Kevin and Catherine. And then the second movie is this very, very tense in space adventure that just thinking about it, my palms are starting to sweat. I've never seen Gravity. I will never see it because I have a huge fear of heights and apparently a fear of getting lost into the void of space also.
It's like baby's first Apollo 13.
Yes, very much so. I agree.
Way before the movie Apollo 13 was actually out.
Way before the movie. But yes, that's exactly right.
Going back to the movie, I was shocked how sweet it is, how respectful it is to its characters, and how it's a little kid's fantasy that if you want to break apart the logic, it's going to fall apart immediately. But it's very sincere about its characters, and it likes everybody. And it doesn't put anyone down, really.
It is low on backstory and high on character development.
There's something I love that is said about 20-some-odd minutes in the movie where Rudy is talking, and he goes, I love science.
I love science.
Sweet to see a movie that doesn't ridicule anyone for wanting to learn something. So this was at the height of Nerds and Jocks. Like, he was just in the Revenge of the Nerds. And to turn around and just say, no, it's okay to be not a nerd, but just a normal person who wants to learn stuff. And that it treats everyone in the movie because Kelly Preston's character, Tish, they're constantly playing against the dumb blonde concept. And I think with everyone.
Or the Valley Girl.
Or the Valley Girl. And I love that where everyone is just like, no matter where everyone comes from, everyone's capable, everyone's smart, and all of them can work together to solve the problem.
Yeah, they're teenagers and they're smart, but let's make them normal and all catty and stuff. Like, they stayed away from that, which I appreciated. And I kind of forgotten that they stayed away from that dynamic, especially in the beginning when the two of them are really first meeting Catherine and Tish. But I really appreciated, especially in that initial interaction when they're in their dorm. It's clear the differences between the two. Like, Catherine is very, very brainy and focused and probably overly serious. And Tish is super smart, but she's kind of flighty and, you know, likes makeup or whatever, because that's like the code for it in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then they have their first interaction and nobody ridicules anybody. Nobody rolls their eyes at anybody. I just thought that was really nice. So I always appreciated the fact that they didn't give into that dynamic.
Yeah.
That's a big pet peeve with me for movies.
That conversation almost passes the Bechdel test too. I mean, it opens up with them talking about Kevin and then talking about boys. But for a while, it's just like science. And I have to say, I mean, growing up, of course, you know, Leah Thompson's character, Catherine, was the one I focused on.
Ditto.
She was pretty but unassuming. The guy liked her. She was so smart. She was, you know, beaten down by the people around her. So, you know, hashtag relatable.
Yeah.
She, rewatching it, I have to say, I was kind of put off by how Andy initially approaches Tish. And I know that it was sort of the, if you'll pardon the phrase, the sort of like landing guide for the audience of like, here's how you should feel about this character, but we're going to surprise you. Where she sort of looks at her funny and thinks that she's weird. You know, like, what is this about an alien DJ? But she's also talking about JPL and she's so brilliant. I don't know. I was kind of like, Andy, you've got to support your ladies. Ladies supporting ladies in the space program. So I'm really glad that Tish and Catherine then had that great conversation a few minutes later, showing that both of them are brilliant in different ways. And that's what makes a great shuttle team / that's what's important in life. Everyone brings something different to the table and we should celebrate that instead of being like, you're weird. You must not be smart because you wear makeup.
Yeah. I mean, Andy, as much as I like the character, she's a little uneven, so
yeah.
She's supposed to be this inspiring figure and clearly is, and yet she tends to be a little too much of a hard ass. And I don't know if this is just a choice that Kate Capshaw made her on her own or if it was something that was like a little bit more of a written in the script specifically. I don't know. I have my own thing with Kate Capshaw. Like, I like her, but I find her not like, she's not my favorite. So
yeah, it feels like she has a chip on her shoulder, but we don't really understand why.
For no reason, it seems like.
Yeah.
At least with the kids. I mean, I know why she has a chip, but like, it seems oddly applied to have a chip on her shoulder with the kids themselves. Like, it's not their fault she didn't get picked, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. And also, I mean, I could easily go down the path of like who, what, why? Like, wait, so you were an astronaut?
I know, I'm trying not to go down the hole.
I know. So I guess if you're an astronaut and you don't go up, you're just automatically bumped to teach at space camp and NASA can afford to have these $1 million robots running around.
No, I think that was her husband's fault.
Ah, yes.
I am fascinated by Andy, though, because I like the fact that she directly confronts Catherine, where she's like, why are you so hard on me? And she is saying in a coded way about the double standard women are treated in the space program. Mm-hmm. And how,
sure,
like, you have to be perfect, otherwise they will never accept you.
Yeah.
That was the first time that I actually had ever heard of that in the movie. The idea of the double standards of how much harder it is to be a woman or even a minority, because, like, you know, we grow up as minorities, and then we always would see, oh, it's a bunch of white guys and one woman and one, maybe one or two minorities in the background, and that's who gets to go to space.
Yep.
Yeah, the IBM guys with the skinny ties and glasses. Yeah.
And I really like that scene where she's aware enough to know what she's doing to Catherine, and she can explain it to her after a certain point. And I like that Catherine actually folds initially when she's trying to make decision-making where there's no room for error in space. And I like the fact that they do the baton pass where, you know, the authority figure has to get injured and or dies, like, you know, Gandalf and Obi-Wan and all those characters. So, of course, you know, something's going to happen to Andy. Yeah. But I like the fact that the way everyone reacts to when it happens feels very real. It doesn't feel like, oh, we're all magically competent now.
Yes.
Yeah, and Catherine feels
it does feel earned. It feels earned. And she screws up. Mm-hmm. So a lot, actually.
Yeah. Almost gets the shuttle blown up.
Yeah. There's several points at which she just completely screws up. Yeah.
What I appreciated upon rewatching it this time was the almost absence of toxic masculinity. There are no figures like directly applying this kind of harmful attitudes and pressure. And none of the teenagers display it either. Like Kevin, the way he flirts with Catherine is very honest and disarming. And I'm just saying that if we had more Kevin and less Elon Musk, I would be very excited to see that.
Yes. The one character that you would expect to have at least a little bit of that is Kevin. And yeah, he's kind of a burnout and doesn't care about things. But like, you know, he's not toxic. He's just an idiot sometimes.
He's like the Hawkeye of the group. They even have him in
the Hawkeye. Yeah. And it's endearing. Yeah, exactly. Like constantly until he has to like get his craft together. But yeah, no, I agree. I really appreciate that too. They're sort of giving everybody their own, you know, space to be respected in and not, you know, play into these stupid tropes that are just used a lot, like literally everywhere all the time. Yeah. So,
well, there is one trope that they lean on heavily for the plot, which is Jinx.
Yes.
Jinx. My favorite of the 80s sidekick robots, by the way.
Yes. Yes. I was telling Roth that this is a boy and his dog story, only apparently in the 80s it was a boy and his
totally.
Robot.
And he's my favorite. He's always been my favorite.
I have to give credit to the design of Jinx, because most robots are these things that if they tip over, you feel like, well, that's it. It's screwed.
That's true.
But what I like is they designed it like a ball, which means it would rotate back to its center of gravity.
It's proto BB-8.
Yeah.
Yes. And
it feels like it could work.
I was telling Ralph, is this supposed to be a reference to Sputnik? And then later I thought about it and I was like, no, he literally looks like a planet. I was intrigued rewatching this at Max and Jinx's mutually codependent relationship. I have this theory that they could have this total Gift of the Magi spinoff because they both go to extreme lengths to try to make one another happy.
Totally.
I love that Joaquin Phoenix feels so much like Mikey from the Goonies when he's talking to Jinx, when he's giving him his big power speeches.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
Although I think the NASA really needs to investigate the three rules of robotics with this robot, because this robot just blew through millions and millions of dollars.
$27 million he cost.
$27 million handyman. I love that line.
Well, I'm talking about the cost of the space flight.
No,
that just did.
Totally.
This is true. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's like, oh, well, my friend wants to go, so, oh, well, that's too bad for you. I'm just going to blow all this money.
Yeah, like, how do you explain that to PR, like, robot malfunction? Like, oh, the
I like the way that Zach wants to handle it. He's like, tell them we lost my wife and five kids. They'll never believe
it.
When you look at the suspense and everything of the movie, is that regardless of the silliness of Jinx, it treats it all pretty seriously. Like I said, the thing I forgot was how straight it plays all of it. So that when you get into the space stuff and once they're up there, it gets pretty much down to the facts of, oh, you need oxygen, you need this, you need to do that, you need to do this, you need to do that. And so you got all these people in control room trying to solve the problem. And it is like a little Apollo 13 where you got Terry O'Quinn, you know, on the microphone being serious, and all you're missing is a bunch of people smoking cigarettes and dabbing them out and really tense and drinking coffee.
If anything, it reminded me of that Community episode that's a parody of The Right Stuff. Clearly they were honing in on the correct space movie elements. I also want to talk briefly about the fashion in this movie. Well, I've already mentioned the Hawkeye shirts on Kevin, but I also just want to send one more shout out to Tish's incredible super 80s look. I love that she's got like the big baggy plastic shorts with the lace leggings, just all sorts of fashion memories. And special shout out to Kevin's sweater, because over the recording of this season of the podcast, I have come up with this idea for a book called Nostalgia Knits. K Nostalgia Knits. Sweater patterns from 80s movies. I'm going to have that pattern in it. I want to have the El Wapo sweater from The Three Amigos. I want to have that weird sweater the dad from Beetlejuice wears. All of the sweaters from Fright Night and The Shining. I'm just saying that I want to make this happen. And if anyone's listening to this and designs sweaters, send me a message, because this would fly off the shelves. I'm just saying, people would buy this. And then Rafa would make the El Wapo sweater, and that would make me extremely
happy. A sweater!
It's so hard to find that pattern. I cannot find it online. I just want to say, because it made me so uncomfortable, there is this scene where the women, where Tish and Catherine are looking at the schedule, and they're talking to Tom Skerritt, and he's like, oh, hi, you two. And then he touches Catherine's face before he walks away, and I'm like, Tom Skerritt, don't touch the teenage girls. This is so creepy. I did not like that at all.
Yeah, he's going to a very dangerous zone.
I think my brain was too much in the... Because there's always... Whenever I see this movie, especially... Well, I've discovered in the last couple of weeks, but every time I watched it, I could feel my NASA nerd brain going into overdrive, going, they would never let kids sit on a freaking shuttle during a test. Come on.
Right?
So I think...
Right? The insurance alone.
So my brain, I think, was too focused on that, and I missed that entirely.
No, there are so many things in this movie where I'm like, that. Yeah, again, absolutely, that would never happen.
Well, I mean, he's... God knows I love Tom Skerritt, and he's in literally every 80s movie as either a father or a mentor figure. And I really love him. He did have a weird vibe in this movie, and I don't think that this is necessarily the character. I think this is just a thing of 80s movies, because there was a lot of like phrases like all American,
yes,
clean cut, and all that crap. And because you don't hear that anymore, like ever, it hit the ear weird.
Yeah.
So I was like, huh, yeah. Nobody says that anymore.
Yeah, or if they do, it's coded for something like that excludes a lot of people.
So it kind of comes off like, you know, not quite over into so creepy that I find him cringeworthy on screen, but enough that I'm noticing it.
You could say he's not quite in the danger zone.
Oh my God, the danger zone. Oh, I love danger that movie.
Literally, one of my best friends from college just posted on Facebook yesterday something like, "I'm attracted to Tom Skerritt in Top Gun. Does this mean I'm old now?" And I responded, "He's the best of the best. He'll make you better."
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
Word. Yeah.
I think it all dwells in his mustache. If you were to take it off, he would just disappear, kind of like the end of Last Crusade.
But it's true. Like, if you think about it, like the large majority of his roles in the 80s were either as like a father figure or a mentor figure.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about that chemistry between all of them, because Kelly Preston, for instance, we've talked about the character, but not her as an actress. She's fantastic in the movie.
She's so great.
She's so charming. So charming in this film.
And they're good about giving every single member of the team a moment of success in the story. Mm-hmm. So that no one is unnecessary in the narrative.
Yeah.
Nor is it overplayed, where it's just like someone suddenly going, "Man, my trauma is about this. I'm going to solve it by doing this."
Yeah. But like Tish figures out the Morse code. Max actually goes out and gets the oxygen. Rudy gets the wires right. Catherine and Kevin bring the ship in. Yeah. Oh, just hearts all around for everybody.
I do have to say, the space effects and the zero-G effects are just really, really well done for the time.
They hold up.
We watched the interviews for this DVD. We learned a lot about how complicated it was to make the weightless scenes. It just slowed down the movie so much and cost so much money and was so difficult. Like, Leah Thompson was talking about how they had to basically pantomime a lot of it and sort of pretend to be weightless. Whereas in movies like Gravity, they have wires, so they actually can move as if they're free from gravity's bounds.
This is about as good as it got until, like, say, Apollo 13. And what they did on that was they would have people just sit on a little gimbal that would just sort of float them around. Or they were in the Vomit Comet.
I was going to say, didn't they? They built, like, a whole set in the Vomit Comet for a few of those scenes, yeah. No, it holds up remarkably well. Although, when you look closely, when they're inside the shuttle, you could see the green screen thing. Like, you could see it from a mile away. But even so, I mean, it's still pretty well done. And then the outside shots are like, they hold up. I was surprised.
Yeah,
they're as good as the time as they were at the time. So I'm not going to criticize them or make fun of them.
No.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's just something I noticed. But I was still going, God, you know, for the when it was made, this is like fabulous.
Right?
So
they thought it was going to be a huge hit until everything happened.
It should have been.
I both see why they thought that, and B, I also understand why it didn't, because the movie's good. It's just not great. It's just a good movie. And I think part of it is, I think they got the acting right. I think they got the energy of the movie right. But the director's a TV guy. He doesn't feel like Spielberg or the other people, like a Zemeckis. Yeah. He can just guide you around emotionally really well.
Oh,
which is why...
That explains some stuff. Okay.
That might be why it feels so like gloriously in the moment where you don't know a whole lot about, you know, what brought everybody there. I mean, they talk about it briefly, but, you know, there are no flashbacks or anything.
Yeah.
And the ending is just so abrupt. I mean, even the first time I saw this, and I admit I didn't want to see this because I thought it was going to be about the Challenger. The ending, I was like, no, what happens? I want to see them leaving the shuttle. I want to see the ticker tape parade or whatever it will be for this accident that still ended up totally fine.
And all the lawsuits.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, all the lawsuits. Exactly.
Or more.
I know. Yeah, I felt the same way. I was like, oh, that's right. It kind of just ends. Mm-hmm. I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
I think in my brain, I was still picturing like an Apollo 13 homecoming kind of scene, and there was nothing.
Yeah, or at least one shot of a parent being like, "They're home fine. We're not mad at you." Yeah.
Or Dolly to zoom in on Jinx's eyes, like, "I will try again, Max."
I guess they kind of figured, well, we have the triumphant mission control scene. I guess that's all we need.
Yeah.
Which any good space movie has.
Oh, absolutely.
I wanted to work in mission control when I was a kid so badly. I didn't want to be in the space shuttle because, again, like you, afraid of heights. Mm-hmm. But I wanted so badly to be on the headset and, like, call out numbers and stuff. Too bad I was kind of bad at math, so it didn't really pan out.
Oh, same.
But, yeah. There's a shot I love where Tish is clicking the Morse code and then you see the one button that's lighting up, and then they do the pan back, and they cut out the music, and you just hear all the sound effects of Mission Control.
Chills.
Amidst them, like 9 million other blinking lights, and you're like, oh crap, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
It was something I was going to say, but then Sada brought it up when we were watching it, which is that John Williams' score does a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It really does. I had forgotten that he did the score, but then when I saw that come up, I was like, oh, that makes sense. It's like when you understand, oh, he's the one that wrote it, and then you go, oh, right, this totally sounds like John Williams.
Yep.
It makes you think the movie's much bigger than it is.
It makes you remember the movie as a huge epic when, again, it's good.
It's his trademark.
Yeah.
That's his whole thing, right?
Yeah.
One thing I miss about that period, it's easy to get nostalgia about the 80s just because, but what I do like about that mid-80s period, that was like it was a few years after the Star Wars movies and a few years before the superhero movies, starting with Batman, is that it was a sort of mid-decade lull where it was just sort of a period of movies, and we just did Flight of the Navigator. That was also in the school.
Another one of my favorites.
And I do like the idea of the narrative of the kids that are capable. And it's not the kids that are smart-ass movies.
In Flight of the Navigator, which we recorded last weekend, he is a bit of a smart-ass, and Ralph hates that.
It's not the smart-ass part. It's just the fact that he's so... What's going on?
He was gone for 8 years. Sorry, we don't need to rehash that episode. But yeah, we definitely did not agree about...
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I do love that movie, though.
I do, too. Yeah.
That was about disbelief. I like the fact that he wasn't a smart-ass. The way characters, teen characters, have been in movies for the last 20 plus years, which is like the idea that...
That sass can get you further than smarts.
Yes. Because our very first podcast was Real Genius, but it's the same thing where, yeah, there's a lot of sass in it, but people are always backing up whatever they say with knowledge and doing things. And I miss that. That's what I miss.
I did write down that, like, my favorite of the lines that Jinx utters is Max puts them back together after the altercation and in the dorm area. And then he was like, oh, those guys, they should be zapped or whatever. And then he immediately takes off. He's like, where are you going? He's like,
to zap them.
I love that. I love that. I don't know why I love it. I just love it.
I was just screaming about that line, laughing so hard at it. Because not only is he like, to zap them, but he's got the little zapper thing going. And you're like, oh my God, he's really going to do it.
I know. And it actually zaps. You're like, oh my God, he's going to go get
them.
Yeah. I did write down WTF with the design of Daedalus. I was like, you can't get the oxygen? What the hell?
Right? Yeah. How a person put it there?
That was the only thing that I was like, come on, NASA's smarter than that. Like,
yeah.
That's the only thing that I was like, come on, guys. But obviously they needed it for the story, but I just thought that was funny. But yeah, I think I covered most of what I would have wanted to say here.
Like we said, amazing John Williams score. And I love that they played the two Dire Straits songs, So Far Away and Walk of Life, back to back, because it really felt like somebody just had a stereo on and was playing a tape, as opposed to like the perfectly crafted movie soundtrack. You know what I mean? I don't know why. I also really like those songs and think that they're featured in way more movies than they actually are, because they just feel like good cinema background music.
I also love cheesy 80s montage music.
Oh, yeah.
Super cheesy 80s montage music, for sure. And this montage was interesting in that it had the voiceover, which usually it doesn't. They just do the scenes and stuff, but this one had an actual narration. I was like, oh, that's different.
Yeah, efficient information dump. I wonder if they knew they were going to do that line over, or if they just were like at the end, like, we just got to compile all this real quickly.
I think they compiled it. It sort of feels like it, because all the bits don't feel like it's, oh, we're doing stuff. Ugh, we're getting tired.
It's all mid-action.
It's actually story information, because everything they go through in Space Camp has a payoff when they're in the shuttle at some point or another.
The setup and payoff on this is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. It is weird, though, when Kevin first walks up to the group claiming that he's Hideo Takamine, and Catherine looks kind of annoyed. Rewatching it, I thought, was there a scene where they met and clashed and they just cut that out? Or is she just annoyed because he showed up late? I don't know.
She does seem kind of annoyed a little too much at the very, very beginning. Like, I can see after the fact, like, oh, he's completely unserious. All right, fine. You could be annoyed at him. But, like, he walks up and it's like, What?
Yeah.
I never liked how they let Kevin get away with taking Hideo's place.
Yeah.
Thank
because
you.
Those that's Thank like $7,000.
Well, no, I mean,
I know,
and back
and
then
Andy
that was a lot.
Is so by the book, like it doesn't even make sense narratively. I'm like, what? She's by the book. Why would she just be like, okay, I guess I have a Donald. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so rude. That happened to me in marching band where I got bumped off one of the buses because the drum major wanted to sit with her boyfriend. Clearly this did not bother me or impact me, you know, 20 years later. But I'm just saying, if you lie and take somebody's place, it has a lifelong impact. And then they end up making a podcast about Space Camp. So maybe it ended up working out okay.
It just doesn't make me like Kevin.
Yeah.
And actually, I do want to ask, what did y'all think about Kevin when you were kids? Because he's designed as the dreamboat.
He is designed that way. I didn't have any real great feelings about him. I think I didn't tend to develop crushes like that when I was a little girl. Plus, I was like 7 years old or around eight when this movie came out. So I was still a little young for that anyway. But I didn't think that he was anything that I thought was a good person or anything, because even by then I had gone through quite a bit of bullying at school. Mm-hmm. So he kind of represented like the cool kid to me. And those cool kids were never nice. So I was kind of mildly annoyed, but mostly just neutral on him when I was a kid. And then that came back when I was watching. I was like, oh, right, he's the cool kid. Like, but he's definitely painted as a dreamboat. And I don't know, maybe I would have felt differently if I had seen the movie when I was like 13 or 14 or whatever. But even then, probably not.
What I like about him after the fact, I still think his entrance, he's just an absolute dick.
Oh, but totally.
Who likes Eric Clapton?
Oh, what a rebel.
Yeah,
I think that's so funny that that's like that's the song that he's like really grooving out to. But
thank you. I was like, really? Teenagers listen to this? And
yes!
Come
this
on.
Is the representation of youthful rebellion? Okay, fine movie.
I mean, I'm fine with it. I just thought it was an odd choice. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry, Rob.
And I'm sort of going back to what Sada was saying, is that once you get past his first few scenes, what I do like about him is he listens to everybody around him. Like, he listens to Rudy, yes. Listens to Catherine. He does become a pretty good mission commander in that he's...
Shuttle commander.
He's clearly processing that's everything that's going on, like when they have their screw up in the shuttle simulator, which is the real shuttle simulator at Space Camp, I think. They ask him what goes wrong, he knows everything that happened wrong because he was paying attention. And that aspect mm-hmm. of the character as a listener made him far more interesting, but he still took that badge, and that makes him a dick in my book.
I liked him because he was funny. I was always drawn to the super funny characters, you know, your Venkmans.
Venkman. Love Venkman.
Yep. Val Kilmer's character, Chris in Real Genius. like, that was my jam. That was what I was into when I was very, very young. Like, when he's in the simulation and making all the jokes about, like, the Earth rotating, and I'm sorry, Catherine can't come to the phone right now. No survivors! Like, I thought he was hilarious.
Yeah, no, that was funny.
So I was into that, but I didn't like that he was so mean to Max. But rewatching it, I will say, I feel like the movie tries to sort of set him up as complicated, because when you meet him, yes, he's stealing Tom Skerritt's parking space, but he's also saying, I wanted to have my head examined, but my dad said I could go to space camp and get a car. And I'm trying to remember what therapy was seen as in the 80s. I guess I'm trying to see if that was setting him up to be like progressive and introspective, or if it was more that he was a flake. I don't know, but that was such a random detail to introduce him as a character. And then in the scenes when he's flirting with Catherine, like, you know, relocking her up in the simulator where she goes around and around. First of all, rewatching it as an adult, very hot. Like, he's flirting with her. It's very well done. Like, if I'd seen that as a teenager, I would have been like, damn. So I get it, you know, because he's flirty without feeling like too creepy about it. It's also good sweater.
I think it's that scene.
Very good sweater.
That key scene you were talking about before, where they're out by the launch pad at night. And what he's doing is really asking her, what do you believe in, type of thing? Because he's very honest, like, I don't believe in this. But he doesn't belittle her belief in it.
Yeah.
And he's true. And I think that's his charming aspect, is he sees the worth in what she sees in it.
Yeah. Like, he tells her not to take it so seriously, and she tells him, she makes some pretty good arguments for why he should take it more seriously.
They're a good balance.
Yes. Yeah. I would watch a spinoff sitcom about those two, but only if Tish and Rudy and Max were there too. Okay. So maybe just a spinoff about everybody.
Although apparently they're going to remake the movie. I heard, did you guys hear
they've been
that?
Trying for like a decade. Yeah, that's nothing new.
Doesn't Disney has a hold of it right now or
I bet it'll be a
like
Disney
that.
Plus
yeah.
movie.
Not everything needs to be remade, guys.
Yeah, but Disney going to Disney. I also want to talk about this movie in light of the fact that it was released after the Challenger explosion. Roth and I spent yesterday watching the Netflix show.
Yeah.
What was it? Challenger, The Final Flight. It was good. There were some issues with it. We wanted more information about, you know, what happened after the commission figured out what went wrong. I'm always here for more Richard Feynman. God, I love him, but
of course
I could talk about that
Who
forever.
Isn't?
But what was interesting to think about then, especially in light of this podcast, was how much PR NASA was doing for the shuttle program and what an effort it was to get the public really excited about the shuttle program and to get kids passionate about learning about space and going into space. And that's partially why I rewatched the movie today. And it's very much all about that. Reese, like what you were saying about, you know, the quote unquote all American kids, it almost feels for the first several minutes like an advertisement for the space program. And that's why I'm especially glad that the characters are so interesting, because it does move past that.
I am actually going to say something opposite to what we were saying a few minutes ago. I think this is actually a good movie to remake, because it's not so good that you could not improve on it, in my opinion. It's when you have a really great movie. It's why redo it? Whereas, and this is the bones of a really good idea, because there is a bit of apathy towards the space program. Like, a lot of the stuff that you see about it is, oh, it's another Tom Hanks recreation of something in the past that was great type of thing.
Another Tom Hanks
Or it's, isn't it, here's this dystopian future where what if the Nazis are on the moon or whatever, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's always treated as if that's it. We've gotten to the point of what we're really going to be able to do here for the next while. I'd like to see the aspirational stories about it again to get people more excited about it again, because I think it's an endeavor worth going into more, and we keep defunding space programs more and more unless it's privately financed.
Endeavor, I see what you did there.
Yes, and so I'd rather have more space camp than Space Force.
No, you know what? I hadn't thought of it that way, so I could totally see why that would be beneficial. And I agree. Like, there's just not a whole lot that's aspirational anymore. It's just really good stories and, you know, movies that are good, but, like, nothing that's really aspirational the way that these were. So, yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I mean, right now, it's my nostalgia that's talking with the whole, don't remake it. It's hard not to do that.
You can't top the Scarrett.
I mean, can you really? No.
You can get like Bryan Cranston. Get him a big old mustache.
Bryan Cranston would be fantastic, and I would be 100% behind that. I would watch the hell out of that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so who should play Andy in the remake?
Connie Britton a few years ago would have been great. Tons of English and Australian actresses can do it. I know. I'd actually like a good black actress to play the role.
I was just thinking that. Or a Latinx woman. That would be incredible. Or even Kelly Marie Tran.
Yeah.
That would be cool. Aww.
Melissa Fumero. Mm.
That would be awesome.
I love her. She could bring a little humor to it.
Yes. Oh, my God. She would be amazing.
Yeah. I could see that.
And then we spend the next 5 minutes of podcast time going.
Let's see.
But that's always what I feel, is that you take the movies that are pretty good. Mm-hmm. And
that still have a message that you want to tweak a little and re-release, but there's a heart of it that you want to sort of bring back to the surface. So let's talk about, it sounds like we all would recommend rewatching this movie for sure. What about somebody who'd never seen it?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend that people check it out. I mean, yes, it's definitely of its time, made by a studio that doesn't even exist anymore. But yeah, I think it's worth a watch. It's entertaining. It's aspirational. It's goofy in that 80s kind of way. That's a good thing and not a like cheesy thing, although it's a little cheesy. It's 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's got the best robot sidekick of all time. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And I'm struggling to think if there are any things in it that don't.
All-American clean-cut kid, I think, is the only thing I can think of. The rest, well, although, you know, and this also kind of stuck out to me, and I don't know if this was a thing that they said a lot in the 80s in the space program, or maybe it just flowed better when I was a kid or something. But the phrase going up, like, never, you know, I think I've seen too many like NASA documentaries and stuff like that. And I'm just like, nobody says that.
Oh.
So it kind of hit my ear wrong.
Interesting.
That phrase.
Okay. People.
It felt dated.
People who are remaking this movie don't say that. Apparently it doesn't seem like it's a real thing.
And I think that would be the big difference too, is that they would spend time researching the whole thing a lot more.
Yeah.
Because you can feel a lot of the space stuff they had in other movies. It's kind of like you could tell people, it's like, it sort of sounds like this. As opposed to, mm-hmm. say, you know, Apollo 13, which holds up because John Sayles did a really great rewrite on it. And they did a boatload of research with the actual people, and they had all the audio logs, so they could have them say verbatim what they said.
Yeah, I think I was just spoiled by movies like that.
Well, we think Space Camp will make you happy, folks.
Yeah, check it out if you haven't seen it in a while. And if you haven't seen it, you're going to recognize so many actors and actresses. It's a fun way to spend a couple of hours. It's both charming and genuinely thrilling. And I learned stuff. You have far greater expertise in NASA and the space program, but I remembered, like, this movie taught me what a window was, as far as, like, you couldn't just fly back to Earth at any point. There had to be a window. It got me thinking about things like oxygen tanks, about how important it is to know Morse code. I only know how to do SOS, but I know that at the very least.
Yeah, it definitely fed into my extreme NASA nerdery when I was a kid. And in a lot of ways, for a lot of those concepts, was the jumping off point. So this holds a very special place for me, this
movie. It was brought up on the special edition Blu-ray, available from Kino Lorber.
Please sponsor us.
I know.
And I think it fits, like we discussed a few times in the episode with Real Genius, as being a movie that inspired a lot of people to get into sciences and the space program. I think for people that are into that genre in general, I think we'll find a lot to like.
Yeah. Well, from Team Space Camp and our fantastic guest, Reese, thank you again so much for being here today.
I was so happy that you guys wanted to have me on, so... Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. And you can read Reese's fantastic book blog at...
It's notoriousmbg.com, and then on Instagram at notorious.mbg.
And she is an absolute delight in person and in social media. And I can't wait till we go to Vegas again and to the McDonald Observatory.
Yeah.
It's going to be out of this world with our $27 million handyman nowhere to be seen because he's messing with the servers probably. Sitting on the couch thinking about the magic of space travel and just being really grateful for spending this morning with all of y'all together and thinking about a really fun movie with some really great messages and great characters. This has been What the Kids Were Watching.
Yay!
What the Kids Were Watching has been produced and hosted by Sada Ruiz and Rafael Ruiz. Theme music provided by Pete Seibert. For more information on our podcast and to read the companion blog, really more of a cartoon sidekick, you can go to whatthekidswerewatching.com. You can also find us on social media. Look for What the Kids Were Watching on Facebook, What the Kids Were Watching on Instagram, and What the Kids Were on Twitter. What the Kids Were Watching, copyright 2021, RAR Works, LLC.